If you love true crime, you won't want to miss the True Crime Podcast Festival on July 13th, 2019 in downtown Chicago. You'll get to see some of the biggest names in podcasting. There are over 80 true crime podcasters coming, including The Vanished, True Crime Obsessed, Crime Writers On, The Fall Line, Generation Y, Canadian True Crime, Already Gone, Misconduct, True Crime Fan Club, The Apex and the Abyss, Crime and Precedence, The Trail Went Cold, and many more. This is a full-day event, and it gives you a chance to meet your favorite podcasters in a large-scale meet-and-greet, with several panel discussions and live episodes, too. To find out more and join the almost 400 people who have bought tickets, head to truecrimepodcastfestival.com or look for it on social media. We can't wait to see you there. Before we begin the show, I wanted to update you on a few changes to the True Crime Fan Club Patreon. Beginning in mid-May, I will be launching a patron-only podcast called True Crime Fan Club Prime. Patrons at the $10 level will have access to this new podcast and be able to pick show topics that I wouldn't normally cover on the main show. For patrons at the $2 to $5 level, you will receive access to ad-free episodes and bonus patron-only content. There is, of course, no obligation to join, but I wanted to let you know about the updates, so head to patreon.com/tcfcpod to learn more.
Explicit content is found in this episode. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome back to the True Crime Fan Club Podcast. I'm your host, Lainey. According to childhelp.org, an average of 5 children a day die due to child abuse and neglect. There are an average of 3 million reported cases of abuse annually. 80% of child maltreatment fatalities involve at least one parent. Child maltreatment fatalities are undercounted by 50% or more. Often, the system can fail a child by allowing them to return home to an abusive environment. All too frequently, children are killed by their caregivers. In addition to the usual content warning, please be aware that today's episode contains crimes against children and is particularly brutal. Listener discretion is advised. Okay, on to the show. March 28th, 1994, was Shayna Bryant's 4th birthday. What should have been a happy time for this little girl was marred with pain, anger, tragedy, and ultimately, death. Around 7:30 p.m. that night, Officer Michael Kelly responded to a 911 call in the Bronx for a child who had an asthma attack. When he arrived at the apartment, he saw Shayna Bryant lying on her back on the kitchen table. She was dressed in a t-shirt and shorts. The child was unresponsive. She was covered in bruises, including one tremendous bruise on her forehead, and had cigarette burns on her arms. Shayna had apparently been beaten to death. Emergency medical personnel were present on the scene, as well as Detective Thomas Murray. Frank Catton of the Crime Scene Unit also reported. The father, Orlando Bryant, was present in the apartment. Officers observed blood throughout the apartment, on walls, beds, and in the bathtub. Human feces was on the bathroom floor. The blood was concentrated in one bedroom in the back of the apartment. Shayna lived in the apartment with her parents, Orlando and Sharon Bryant. She had 4 siblings, sister Alonda, Joy, and Sharon, and brother Ramon. Emergency responders took Joy to the hospital on the night of Shayna's death due to a swollen lip, a severely burned hand, and bruises on her face. Ellen Borikov, spokeswoman for the medical examiner's office, reported that the cause of death was child abuse syndrome. The injury suffered by Shayna had been sustained over time. She had cigarette burns that were healing, as well as other injuries that were in various stages of healing. She also had a bruised heart and a bruised pancreas. The medical examiner testified that the bruised pancreas was at least 2 days old. There were numerous scars and abrasions on her torso and on her legs that appeared to be fingernail scratches. She appeared to have been previously choked. There were also what appeared to be ligature marks on Shayna's ankles and wrists, suggesting she had been restrained and had struggled against those restraints. Injuries to Shayna's genitals and buttocks seemed to point to her being kicked, slapped, or punched in those areas. The medical examiner also found several abrasions in her mouth and noticed that some of her teeth had been knocked out. There were two areas of bleeding on her scalp that indicated Shayna had suffered blunt force trauma to her head at the time of her death. The autopsy also revealed through her distended abdomen and low body weight that she was severely malnourished, which prevented her body from being able to heal itself like it ordinarily should. Shayna's father, Orlando, was arrested shortly after the police arrived at the apartment. Shireen had left the apartment with the other children and went to a friend's house shortly after 911 had been called. She was located the next morning and arrested. Most of their neighbors, as well as their minister, thought Shireen was a good mother, although she seemed overwhelmed at times. The minister told reporters he had just seen Orlando shortly before Shayna's death, and he said he had been too busy to come to church lately. The two older children had been at church the day before Shayna's death. They had attended with a neighbor, and the minister said they looked fine. As the investigation progressed, it was discovered that Shireen Bryant had lost custody of the children twice before because of her cocaine use. Three of her children had been born with cocaine in their system. Orlando Bryant sought and was awarded custody of the children in 1990. However, the family courts and city were apparently not aware that Orlando Bryant had served time for assault and drug distribution in 1984 and 1985. Sheila Jack, a spokesperson for the Human Resources Administration, said that when a parent applies for custody of their child who is in foster care, they only check to see if there were complaints of abuse or neglect and not the parent's criminal record only. The Human Resources Administration, also called the HRA, manages child welfare. New York state law prohibits access to criminal records for custody cases. This case was high profile, as Mayor Rudy Giuliani became involved after the death of Shayla Bryant. He requested Marva Hammons, the HRA commissioner, come to his office to discuss this death and ask for a thorough investigation of the handling of this case by the HRA. The mayor said the HRA had known about aspects of the case since 1987. Mayor Giuliani took a different approach to these cases than his predecessor, David Dinkins, who never discussed child abuse investigations. During Dinkins' time in office, the HRA would not discuss child abuse cases, citing confidentiality laws. Mayor Giuliani's office took the stance that while he respected the confidentiality laws, he wanted transparency regarding the city's role. The three oldest children had attended daycare at Friendship Church until May before Shayna's death, until daycare workers discussed some concerns about the kids with their parents. Shireen and Orlando Bryant's response was to remove the children. Reverend Thompson never saw signs of abuse on the children. One of the Bryant's neighbors, Sylvia Free, said that she would look after the Bryant children occasionally when Shireen had a run to the store. During those short periods of time with the children, she never had any indication that anything was wrong. Another neighbor, Jeanette Duggins, said the children were always neat and clean, and that she often took turns walking the children to school with Shireen. The surviving children told detectives that the night Shayna died, the beating started in Ramon's room. Orlando had beaten Shayna in Ramon's room. Then Orlando and Shireen both hit and kicked Shayna in the bathroom. Shayna allegedly took a drink out of the toilet at some point in the night, which incensed her parents even more. The beating then moved into the hallway, where Shayna soiled herself as she cried. Orlando put her on the couch, but then moved her to the kitchen table. Joy pretended not to know what had happened and asked Shireen, who told Joy to mind her own business, so the same wouldn't happen to her. The 911 call was made, and then Shireen left for her sister's house. The children also told the detectives that their parents would often tie them to a chair and leave them there all night, but it was usually just Shayna that this happened to. Detectives discovered that the children in the Bryant household were given a terrible choice, a choice between getting a beating or going without food for 2 days. This was what sparked the deadly beating of Shayna. She had misbehaved in some way, and one of the parents caught her sipping water out of the toilet. It is not entirely clear which parent caught her, since they each pointed the finger at each other. There was no food in the refrigerator. In family court, the oldest girl said that the parents had poured boiling water on Shayna and scalded her head. The week before Shireen went to trial, Orlando pleaded guilty to second-degree murder in order not to face first-degree murder charges. He received 18 years to life. When Orlando pled guilty, he admitted that on at least 4 occasions, he and Shireen had tied Shayna to a chair until she was asleep to keep her from rubbing the bump on her forehead. He pointed the finger at Shireen, stating that she was abusive to Shayna and that she would burn her with cigarettes, hit her, and even told all the children that she hated them. During Shireen's trial, the 3 oldest children testified, where children were once not used in the courtroom because people believed their memories were faulty and they could not separate the truth from lies, they were now being used more and more, as they can be credible witnesses. Daniel Armash, senior attorney for the National Center for Prosecution of Child Abuse in Alexandria, Virginia, said in an interview, "Children by and large have as much credibility as any adult. To determine the competency of juveniles, New York judges have to interview them away from juries. Judge Joseph Fish did this in the Shireen Bryant case and also refused to allow them to be questioned via closed-circuit television. This is sometimes done, allegedly, to protect the children, but more often than not, to lessen the emotional impact of having the children testify against their mother in the same courtroom." Alonda 9, Joy 7, and Ramon 8, who went by the nickname Rocky, had not seen their mother since Shayna's death. Alonda and Joy were wearing beige linen dresses and smiled and waved at their mother when they saw her. She blew them kisses back. Rocky was wearing a green sports coat that was a few sizes too big and had a Star Trek action figure in his hand. He waggled his finger separately at his mother, and she waved back the same way. The kisses and waves stopped, however, once the children started their testimony. Alonda said she watched her mother burn the bottom of her sister Joy's feet with a curling iron just months before Shayna's death. In 1993, before Joy's birthday, their parents pushed Joy onto a wall, which caused her to go blind in one eye. Shireen then tied Joy to the chair and then burned her hand by rolling a hot curler back and forth on her hand. Orlando often took Joy to the bathroom and beat her. Joy was beaten with a belt and burned on the neck with cigarettes and on the arm with a clothes iron. There was also a time Shireen threatened to cut Joy's tongue out while holding a knife. Shireen never took the children to the doctor, although one time, one of the children was seen by a doctor for their burns. One of the girls told the doctor the burns were an accident while they tried to make a cake for Shireen. Alonda said that her mother always told Shayna she hated her and that she was ugly. Shireen's defense attorney asked Alonda if she loved her daddy and her mommy, and she gave a loud yes and was told she could step down, but instead started sobbing. Rocky testified that he had seen his daddy and mommy hitting his sister Shayna when she was drinking water from the toilet. When asked about his father hitting his mother in the face, he said he had seen it happen, but only about twice. Even though their mother never sought medical treatment for her children's wounds, she did seek treatment for her own injuries when Orlando assaulted her. Orlando had beaten her bad enough to cause broken teeth, broken ribs, and even broken vertebrae. Shireen testified that Orlando had used his hands, feet, and even a billy club, hanger, and shoes to beat her. She saw a doctor after a broken nose and had her teeth capped, which broke Orlando's house rule that family business stayed in the family. He had punched her in the mouth because she had become too independent by joining a methadone program. Bryant testified that in her world, a man hitting a woman was just a normal way of life, so she never reported it to police. She did feel unable to stop him, but she was aware of an ex parte order of protection and had won against a man she had lived with previously. According to Shireen, Orlando would beat her or one of the children in the bathroom so that the others could not see what was going on. She also said, though, that she would tell Orlando to stop beating the children for fear the neighbors would hear. Shireen said that Orlando was a drug user who abused heroin and cocaine and got her addicted to both substances. Shireen denied that she was the one who abused her children, claiming that Orlando abused the children. She stated that she had never seen any of the children get burned, but did admit that she did punish Joy for lying by spanking her with a hand or belt. She also admitted she had also used a belt on her other children. Shireen once again blamed Orlando, stating that he burned the kids with cigarettes, although she never saw it happen and he was not a smoker. In the closing arguments, Arnold Cronick, Brian's attorney, claimed that Joy had a history of lying, and the oldest daughter, Alanda, had holes in her memories. He also said that Rocky was too fidgety and nervous to be a reliable witness. He claimed that the children were not reliable because they had been spoon-fed what to say by the prosecutors, although he had been given the same access to the children. Prosecutor Alvin Yearwood painted Bryant as a bad mother who was only worried about herself, comfort, and safety. He called her a bad mother and constantly harped on her while questioning for not showing any emotion. Yearwood also attacked Cronick's comments about the children needing punishment for lying. What lie could be so egregious you would burn them with cigarettes? Yearwood asked in his closing arguments. On the 10th of May, 1996, a Bronx jury convicted Shireen Bryant of second-degree murder. Prosecutor Alvin Yearwood said that Bronx juries do the right thing. Judge Joseph Fish claimed that this was the most draining trial he had ever witnessed. He wished everyone a happy Mother's Day before leaving the courtroom. I'm going to pause the case right here so you can hear a word from our sponsor. Another highly publicized case occurred in New York City approximately 18 months after Shayna was murdered. This death actually created change in the child welfare system because the mother and child were well known to the system, just as Shireen Bryant and her children had been. On November 22, 1995, around 9:24 a.m., a call was placed, reporting a small girl had quit breathing. Emergency services, including police, firefighters, and paramedics, responded to an apartment at the Rutgers House Housing Project in Lower Manhattan. When Elisa Izquierdo was pulled from her bed, responders noticed she was covered in deep red spots. They could not determine if they were welts or cigarette burns. She had severe bruising all over her body. In particular, she had a large one on her right kidney, as well as bruising around her temples. The little finger of her right hand was broken, and the bone was through the skin. There were also severe injuries to her genitals. Michael Brown, with the New York City Fire Department, started CPR, but it was too late. Lieutenant Luis Gonzalez of the New York Police Department said, "In my 22 years of service, this is the worst case of child abuse I have ever seen." Elisa was born in 1989 to Gus Izquierdo, a Cuban immigrant, and Alwida Lopez, a Puerto Rican immigrant. The two had met at a homeless shelter where Lopez lived after being evicted from the apartment she shared with her partner at the time. She had two children with this man. Izquierdo cleaned up and served food at the shelter, The two got together, but Izquierdo broke things off when he realized that Lopez was addicted to crack cocaine. When Elisa was born addicted to crack, social workers took her away from Lopez and gave her to Izquierdo. Gus was not sure how to be a parent, so he took parenting classes, talked to family members, and just tried to be the best father he could be. He doted on the little girl and treated her like a princess. He put her in the Brooklyn YMCA Montessori Day School, rented a banquet hall for her baptism, and took the time to part her hair in a perfectly straight line every day. He did his best to keep Lopez away from Elisa. But unfortunately, Lopez entered drug rehab, married Carlos Lopez in November 1991, and was able to show social services that her life was now on the straight and narrow, just enough to get visitation every other weekend. Elisa's father and teachers tried to tell social workers that the child returned from these visits upset and bruised. One family friend told social workers that Elisa would throw up when she returned home and refused to go to the bathroom. Elisa herself told social workers that her mother hit her. A year later, the visits were allowed to continue, but only with the condition that her mother not hit or slap Elisa. Tragedy soon struck, however. In May 1994, Gus went to the hospital with bad lungs, which turned out to be lung cancer. He died on May 26. Her mother won temporary custody, even though she had no job. Her husband had been sent to prison for stabbing her 17 times with a pocket knife, and she had five other children. The stabbing took place on a weekend when Elisa was at the house. Numerous people wrote letters trying to stop this custody move. Elsa Canizares, a cousin of Gus's, went to court trying to get custody of Elisa. The head of the Montessori school wrote Judge Phoebe Greenbaum to show support of Canizares and to discuss the abuse. Prince Michael of Greece, who had become enchanted with Elisa at the Montessori, even wrote letters in support of Canizares. However, Greenbaum was of the old-school mentality that favored biological families staying together. Making matters worse, Canizares did not have the money to hire legal counsel. Prince Michael offered to pay tuition at the Montessori school, but Lopez refused and put Elisa in a public school. Very quickly, Elisa's refusal to play with other children, her uneven gait, and then an abrasion on her head led teachers and officials at the school to contact social workers and report suspected abuse. Unfortunately, the social services agency refused to investigate, stating there was not enough evidence to proceed. Lopez withdrew Elisa from the school. Elisa was not enrolled in another school, and instead was kept locked in her room most of the time. She was not allowed to watch TV, could not eat with the other children, and was not allowed to use the bathroom. She either urinated or defecated in her bed, or used a chamber pot in her bedroom that overflowed so badly it leaked into the apartment below. Lopez also forced Elisa to eat her own excrement. Neighbors in the building heard the shouts and cries, but thought it was just their way of disciplining kids, so they didn't say anything. The other five children were not targets of abuse. Lopez actually said that Elisa was possessed by the devil. Her brother and sister both believed this, so they never questioned how Lopez treated her daughter. The abuse of Elisa was deep and twisted. One time, Lopez allegedly mopped the floor with Elisa's head. 2 days before Elisa's death, her mother slammed her head into a concrete wall in the apartment. The autopsy revealed that Elisa died from a brain hemorrhage due to a blow to the head. She did not walk or talk after this incident, and it is believed she died the next day, although it was 2 days before Lopez contacted authorities. She called her sister and told her that Elisa was lying on the bed, drooling. The injuries to her genitals were reportedly caused by a hairbrush that Lopez used to torture Elisa. Just days before her death, Elisa attended a birthday party in their building. Her mother was present at the party. A 9-year-old named Eric approached Elisa and asked if she wanted to dance. Elisa was actually a good merengue dancer, having been taught by teacher's aide Barbara Simmons at the Montessori school. But on this night, she was moving stiffly, slowly, awkwardly. Eric said he must have danced at least 5 dances with her before going off to get some cake. He did not realize Elisa was behind him until he suddenly saw her and she got her fingers caught in the door. Elisa's mother tried to get him to go into the bathroom with her to help her wash Elisa's fingers off. But then once in the bathroom, her mother tried to get him to molest the little girl. This shook him to the core and he left immediately. The mother was indicted. She pled guilty on 2nd-degree murder charges with the understanding that she would get out in 15 years, but she has not been released. After Elisa's death, the community raised money for her funeral. Approximately 400 mourners gathered to pay their respects to the beautiful little girl who did not get a chance to live her life to its fullest. The services were officiated by Reverend Gianni Agostinelli, who said Elisa had not been murdered by her mother alone, but by the silence of many, to the neglect of child welfare institutions, and the moral mediocrity that has intoxicated our neighborhoods. In the aftermath of the funeral, Elisa's law was passed. This law holds the Child Welfare Agency of New York City and the Administration of Children's Services publicly accountable for its performance. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to leave us a positive review on Apple Podcasts or your podcast player of choice. It really does help us out. This episode was written and researched by Susie St. John, content editing by Brittany Martinez. You can find us on most social media platforms, Twitter at TCFCpod, Facebook.com/TCFCpodcast. You can also find us on Instagram, TCFC_podcast. And of course, our website is truecrimefanclub.com. If you have an episode request, send us an email, tcfcpod@gmail.com. Audio engineering and custom music for the show was provided by Nico at We Talk of Dreams. Check him out on Twitter at We Talk of Dreams or wetalkofdreams.com.